to Musicals, the podcast where we talk about musicals. It's the most casual podcast in the world, is our new tagline.
That's right.
And today we're talking about Sondheim, who just turned 90 years old, so congrats on staying alive for so long to him. And we're going to talk about one of the only musicals that all of us actually know by him collectively as a trio, because each of us seem to have like a differentiation in our knowledge, which is kind of cool because between all of us we might know all of them in a way.
It's like a three-way Venn diagram where the only thing in the middle is assassin.
Venn diagram, actually.
Yeah, because Devin and I have Into the Woods, and then you guys have what, like a little night music?
Sunday in the Park.
A park and a little night music, I would say we know.
A little night music.
I know Company.
Sweeney Todd, I know.
Oh, well, we all know Sweeney Todd, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
We don't have to do a Sweeney Todd podcast.
It's fringy to me because I don't know it that super well. Assassins is something I know really well. Like, I love this musical a lot. I think you guys
would say
too.
Yeah, I do. Honestly, I listened to it this morning and I was like, oh yeah, I do know every word to this show.
Yeah, it's really great.
I know Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
Like the best, probably.
I feel like if you have an experience with a show, then you like know it better. And it's kind of like with operas, I'm like, I'll never get a chance to like learn these things because I'll never be able to be in them or anything. So you just have to like study them. But with musicals, it's like you have to kind of like run into one and have this like experience with it. And then you keep it with
Speaking of, I feel like I'm never going to know Pacific Overtures, or I feel like I'm probably never going to be in that or listen to it extensively. This show, this is the first show that I practiced calling a show with, because they were doing this show at Near West when I was being trained to do Urinetown, I guess. And
Snow Queen.
I didn't call Snow Queen. Oh. So this was after that. I just was backstage because my aunt passed away. So
could you just say a bit about what you're talking about for the audience?
Yeah. So I did stage manage multiple kids shows at a theater here in Cleveland. And when I was being trained by Ryan, who I just mentioned, who's the stage manager there, they were working on Assassins. And so I would sit in the basement of the theater just with this script and score and listen to it. And then he put two staplers that are like the go button and the crew button. And I would just hit the staplers when I had to. So that was how I practiced first.
Stage manager.
It sounds like kind of offensive at first. You're like, I don't need these staplers. But then it's like, that's a good idea.
No, it literally is. It's low stakes buttons the way that it would be.
So is that the hardest part about stage managing, is that you're reading through this thing and then you're like, this one has to, because you're like sending communications through either light flickering, which is really cool, like a flashing light bulb backstage, or you're telling someone over headset to do something. Like, it's like the juggling and figuring out.
The cool thing about it is stage managing is so much like music. It's so much like being in an orchestra, even if it's a play, because you're either waiting for things to happen from the actors for cues, or you're starting something. So it's like you have to read across and anticipate like what's going to happen. So like with Assassins, there's all kinds of cool stuff where you're waiting for someone to say something to have a gunshot, and then someone reacts, and then you have to change the light. There's a lot of like exciting, almost like movie type, you know, transitions and stuff.
That is so cool that you've gotten that, not only like one time kind of experience with that, but like a really in-depth knowledge of that. I think that's really amazing.
Yeah, it was really fun. This was a cool show to learn that way and like shadow someone stage managing it.
I would say, to that theater's credit, once they know that you've done something, they'll ask you to do it again, whether they should even. That's like the best way that people who didn't necessarily study something can like get experience.
Oh my God, like, it's like in grad school.
Yeah.
Totally. I was going to say that with your costume work. It's like the same kind of like you're doing one other thing that's not exactly being on stage, but you're learning so much about the process. And
And they get cheap labor.
Boy, do they. My
God. And I worked on props.
I guess that's the nature of a community theater.
Yeah, that's very true.
And you did tons of props.
Yeah, and I did props for the show, I think, because I remember us ordering
the Coke bottle.
Drinkable Coke bottles, yes. And I printed out a picture of Jodie Foster for them. So, yes, I did technically work on the show.
So, do you guys want to do, like, a plot summary where it's, like, popcorn and I say, like, Mackenzie, go, and then you, like, pass it to the next person? Do you want to try to do that? Okay.
Sure.
So, I'll start by saying that, like, it's about all of the assassins of the United States presidents who've had either were assassinated or had an attempt on their life. So it goes, it attempts to like take a look at all the assassins at once. And so it doesn't exactly go like, it's not a story necessarily about one of them. It's kind of like the concept. It's conceptually about the idea of assassinating a president. Mackenzie.
Yeah, it's like a Twilight Zone episode. Oh, sorry.
No, Kate.
Go for it.
Yeah, so it's like a crucible where they're all there. So like in whatever like netherworld this is, it's kind of like it's a fairground idea that they're all there like discussing with each other and kind of like competing or comparing stories. And it feels Twilight Zone-y in that way where you're like, how is this all existing at once? Mm-hmm. But it's cool to see them all interacting.
Well, and then if we were to like turn it into something linear, I would say that it isn't it Lee Harvey Oswald who assassinated JFK, and there's like a moment where the like spirits of all of these assassins. So you could kind of understand it as like they're giving context and introducing like all these characters like in a Cats like format.
Yeah, totally. This is the Cats of Sondheim's career.
Violent as fuck.
A Catsons. I want it to happen.
Like a moment where like after like the majority of the show we understand why these people do what they do, and then they all like come to Oswald and it like justifies his decision to do that thing because he's like the Balladeer's the main character, but like Oswald is, or is that, are they the same?
No, that's different people, weirdly. Or no, the Balladeer is, oh, that's the, it's the surprise ending is that the guy who's been telling the story, who's like the narrator, is like, essentially he's been researching all these people, kind, it seems like that, which brings me to my first criticism. Why didn't they take this, why didn't they set this not in a fairground, but in a book depository? Isn't that what it's called? A book
depository? Depository?
It sounds like suppository, like they're putting books up your butt, but that's not what it is. Why didn't they set this, like, because it's basically like he's sitting in that abandoned warehouse waiting for JFK to pull up the entire time, which is like the spoiler, but why don't they have it like he's in that book thing, like reading about them or something? I don't know.
I think the
carnival, though, is like Americana and shoot to win and like play your chances. And
you're right. That is
your West, I think. Near West did a great job.
And it's, I mean, they basically did the Broadway version I saw. They did like the very same concept, other than they split the narrator into four people instead of one person.
And they had a separate person as the Lee Harvey Oswald.
Which
person.
To me is like trying to give more people roles, but it really obscured the idea that this was actually Lee Harvey Oswald. Like,
and
that has nothing to do with what the plot actually is, to have it played by four people.
Also, they cast the four people that, like, they were all the same kind of typecast. So it was like, why?
Yeah, they weren't different parts of his personality.
They were four flamboyant fragments of this.
I could even see if they were all sort of like these incel guys in white t-shirts, like all of them are the same person and it's just different.
Yeah, ooh, to that point, they could have had the whole cast of 40 people as white incel dudes.
That is amazing.
Near West, I mean, Theater.
We're not just criticizing Near West. I'm saying these are good ideas for, like, our version of it, basically. because we're not here to just shit talk one production of this show.
I know, but when I was thinking about my experience with the show, I was like, I can't not mention what they did with the balladeer in that production because it was
wrong. It was wrong.
Yeah.
It was one of those
but
things.
But the assassins that they had were all
oh my
incredible.
God. Like, so that's a great point.
Performances.
Oh my God, they were so incredible. Anna Parchin as Squeaky Frone. Honestly, yeah. Every single person was so good in that show. You're right.
Eddie finally got his chance to be
Oh, yes.
I mean, an interesting thing I've thought about with this show is it can't really have diverse casting in a way because all of these assassins are white, and that's kind of a point to be made, in my opinion. Like,
yeah.
No one attacked a president has been a person of color. A couple of them have been immigrants who were disenfranchised and treated terribly. But the fact that all these people are these like, I want to win the lottery or like have more rights than I have, like kind of
crazy.
Yeah.
Well, but I guess the same argument is like the Lee Harvey Oswald should not be played by minority oppressed people to that point. Like, why would the person who's like, we're trying to essentially say that he doesn't have it right, like he's not solving any issues by killing the president, and we're trying to like prove that point, like why would we cast these four outcasts as that character? Like, that makes zero sense to me.
And like John Wilkes Booth too, and his thing with Lincoln, like, is very racially based.
Yeah.
Right. And all the lyrics are so tongue-in-cheek about like everybody has the right to be happy, and it's like, yeah, these people do, they're doing fine, like they're truly a couple of
right
them,
yeah, because it's supposed to be ironic, like,
a couple of them have terrible living situations or jobs or mental health that is not being treated by the country, and I think that's a big point of this show.
Mm-hmm.
But there's racial discrimination against these people, wouldn't you say? Maybe Czolgosz is like seen as a like immigrant, looked down upon as like an immigrant worker.
No, these are people who are like, yeah, I'm just saying in support of what you're saying, these are the assassins as a group are all whiny white people who think they deserve better, which is very applicable to our times right now.
I think if we even want to like abstract it a little more, I think with like everybody's got the right, it's just like Americans who think that violence is the solution to their problems and that they're entitled to be violent because it's their right, you know? And that's typically white people, but I think that's just like an American ideal that's been perverted since like our revolution. And something that when I was listening to Everybody's Got the Right, it's funny because it almost is like a glimmer of Into the Woods, where it's like the dark side of like make your wish come true type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also like the, not anti-America, but like the critical approach to entitlement that Sondheim has like in all of his shows.
Yeah.
But this one is like specifically tied to American politics and like American ideals and patriotism and stuff like that.
It's
and
such really a good like idea to scrutinize our country through these maniacs. And then like almost the whole time you're like on their side, he wrote it really sympathetically to them. But then at the end, you're like, you can't take someone else's life because you want happiness. Like, you can't rob someone else of their right to be happy. Like, everybody has the right to be happy, and you can't kill someone to get
like
your way.
I like that he highlights, or he talks about all of them, even the attempts, like there are attempted assassinations that don't go through, and also like the wide range of, some people felt like their whole way of life was threatened, which, listen, the Confederacy is evil, but like the fact that John Wilkes Booth at least had this whole like, I'm trying to save what I love about my country thing, that's what his whole song is about, whereas some people like Sarah Jane Moore is just like, I did it so my friends would know where I'm coming from. It's like, what? There are so many different abstract reasons that these people did this, so it's interesting the variety.
Yeah, and it's always related to kind of their own personal mission and then thinking that killing a president will get them the most attention possible, which is a whole like media commentary type situation where it's like people are just trying to be heard, honestly, at the end of the day. And like, if we could listen to outcasted people and include them in the conversation, and I think it does a great job of criticizing them and saying like, we're pushing people too far and we're not listening to them, and they have a right to be heard that they're unhappy. Like, there are a lot of reasons these people are frustrated, and there's no system to help them.
It's like the country makes them feel unworthy, so then they have to like take their sense of worth into their own hands, which for people that have been made to feel unworthy, they're not going to be like rational in their pursuit of like
absolutely
self-expression.
And they've been shown, and I've even gone through this on a smaller scale with like bullying in school. It was like, oh well, I guess if you're going to bully me and it makes me feel small, and the only way I'm going to be able to be heard is not by telling a teacher because then I'm a tattletale, or not by whatever peaceful means I could have come up with, it's like by bullying them back. And then it's like this moment where frustration builds, and then you attack out of that, and it kind of doesn't solve the problem in this musical. It doesn't attempt to. It just like really does a great job of painting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
shedding a light on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great line in the Zangara song where he's about to get electrocuted, where he's like talking about, for Zangara, no photographers, only capitalists get photographers, and he's like saying, even though I did this, I'm not going to get any attention or anything for this because I'm.
That sucks. And it's
nobody, I know. He just keeps saying like, okay, you guys have your thing. Nobody cares about me at all. Like, it's really intense.
But
this has been great.
Another thing, like thought that came to mind was from when How I Saved Roosevelt, is how Americans love to claim that like inaction is like something to be proud of, and like mm-hmm. these people like did, like, thank God I was there because like the way that things worked out was because I didn't let this guy sit down, or because like it's like honestly this has nothing to do with you, and you just want to like make it about your experience.
It's so
like such about the
smart,
like individualized, like, yeah,
it's like the song It's Hot Up Here in Sunday in the Park with George, where it's just like these people like being like really, it's a reflection of the audience essentially.
It's also yeah. like my like your fault in Into the Woods.
Oh, totally
where it's like this wasn't like, I understand the cause and effect situation that was here because it's all about my, like,
and I did the right thing because I had my right reasons. He's very thematic with that, I will say. I was thinking of Into the Woods when I heard the Something Just Broke song. Also, I think because the girl from Into the Woods who played Little Red, I think that actress is in Assassins, which I think he did a lot with the actors. Like Chip Zine was in a lot of stuff. So I just think he like reused Bernadette Peters. So it was cool to hear her voice in that. But I also was like, this feels very much like Into the Woods type. Because out of all the songs, he kind of does these like, it's a little bit Rodgers and Hammerstein, how he wrote this as like a carnival piece. And he wrote that all to be like, da 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 da. And so it's all written based on Americana music. And it sounds very un-Sondheim-y, but then that Something Just Broke song, which is about the day Kennedy died and people remembering where they were, is kind of a mirror opposite of what we were just talking about with How I Killed How I Saved Roosevelt.
How I Killed Roosevelt.
But that song is like a more reverent, like the country really was shaken up by that, and and like coronavirus, things will never feel the same. And like 9/11, it's one of those big moments where just everything, you know, as a country and as a world, you're like, well, however you felt about this person, the world is never going to be the same after that. And that song really chokes me up and makes me.
Yeah, that song is incredible. And it's one of the few that isn't like, like you said, Cats type song of an assassin singing. Like it's one of
right.
the few.
It's a reaction piece. Yeah. Part. Yeah.
Yeah. I have something to say about JFK's assassination real quick, which is that we just discovered a program that my grandpa led a band that was at JFK visiting University of Maine, like a month before he was assassinated. So like, and then there's footage online of JFK being at U of Maine and like my grandpa and his marching band being there, which is so cool. I just
that
learned
is
that.
So cool.
I know. Yeah, but I love Something Just Broke. I think it's like a standout song of this show. Ooh, could we go around and say like what our favorite song is and why? Not assassin, more like song.
I would do favorite assassin also.
Okay, favorite assassin. Is that meaning who we relate to at all? Or is that meaning who we just think is...
Just, you can just say why.
If you relate to somebody, just let us know.
Don't tell us.
Don't say it. Don't say it. My favorite song is Gâteau's song, actually. I really knew
that about you. I love that song so much.
Right. I'll bring up my fun fact later.
Yeah, I love that song. I think it has so many different like layers to it. Just the "I am going to the Lordy" coming back, and it's sort of being brought back into like the story of this man and why he thinks he has a shot at being like an ambassador, and how he thinks God like wants him to do these things. And it's just so like grandiose and cool.
And the end of it with the balladeer coming in is like the most exciting piece of music. It's like their last chord, and then you assume he's killed. He's executed at the end. It's like, that is truly beautiful music, Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, it is.
This is my favorite show of his.
It is?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. And also, can I just take a moment to say that this is the first show I saw on Broadway.
Wow.
Which happened right after 9/11, and they held the show. They did not put it up because there's a monologue that used to be in it about someone crashing a plane into a building. And I don't know exactly the story behind that, so I'm not going to make up the details. But I know that they had to like post... What did you say?
It's the guy, the one guy who doesn't have a song, Samuel Bick. That one?
Yeah, the angry guy. Where's my fucking prize?
Yeah.
So he does this monologue about there being like this basically 9/11 thing, and they were just about to mount, because Assassins was off Broadway originally, and then they mounted this production with Neil Patrick Harris and Mario Cantone is the guy you were just talking about, and honestly, like an incredible cast of people, and it was a really well done production. That's where that fairground, like near West kind of concept was really strong in that one, but. Where was I going with that? Oh, yeah, they like held it again because it's a really controversial topic to put up when the entire country is like already grappling with what's real, what's not real, who should be angriest, who should reclaim power. So that was a very cool first show to go. And I wanted to see Rent, but the person I was there with was like, "You're not going to see Rent." So teenage me was like, "Okay."
When I first wanted to go to Broadway, I was in eighth grade, and I wanted to see Spring Awakening, and my dad was like, "I don't think
that's such
so.
A good show."
I
saw that
but
with my dad.
I can't remember if it was either Wicked or Phantom that I saw first.
That's
and then I
great.
Saw Sam a lot. So it was a good
hey,
lineup.
Hey, that's good.
So we went in ninth grade with my band and tragically saw freaking Blue Man Group instead of a show. But then we had the conductor or like assistant conductor of Aida come do like a class with our band. Like
that's cool. Up.
And yeah, and I like talked to this person. I had like a horn solo or something. So that was cool. But we saw Blue Man Group, which was so depressing.
Were they good?
Yeah, they were fun. But like I would have rather seen a musical. they were like spitting the marshmallows and stuff.
For the people who can't see our video, we are being the Blue Man Group.
We are the
Mackenzie, what's your favorite song?
So my favorite song / assassin is Leaky Frome and totally. Unworthy of Your Love. I'm really into the Charles Manson whole thing, and I like that she's a girl. And I like that song because it's so often you'll like go to like a musical review or something and like theater kids will like sing this song like it's some romantic ballad, mm-hmm. when in reality it's like obsession. Crazy people justifying their like obsession, and like being obsessed with Jodie Foster and Charles Manson in this song, mm-hmm. that's like honestly so beautiful and like heartbreaking.
It's such a good idea for a song. Like, it's so cool to abstract a love song that way, and they don't know each other.
Exactly, a duet about love when it's really them being obsessed with somebody else.
Two other people. Yeah, that's like, when has that ever happened? I mean, I guess it's kind of an old, maybe it happens in old musical theater stuff that I'm not thinking of right now, but I think it hasn't happened well in a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great concept. It's a beautiful song.
What's your favorite?
Mine is, I think my favorite song is the Gun Song.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I was going to look up the lyrics and like sing a piece of it, a little bit of it, but I wish that we could sing more.
Shulgash
and Booth and Gateau.
Oh, it is Gateau in that. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie to you guys. I have the Wikipedia page up because I cannot do this show off the cuff. But I was scrolling through like the history of notable cast members and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And in the reading, the 1989 reading, so I am familiar with the off-Broadway recording, the blue with the white stars.
Yeah. Amazing recording.
Yeah, and I feel like typically people are attached to the recording that they like
first. I actually found out about it through the new one, and I like the old one better still. So I mm-hmm. think that one's.
But apparently, in the read-through. Samuel Bick was played by Nathan Lane.
That's what? Funny.
Yeah.
Nuts.
Isn't that crazy? That,
yeah, that is crazy.
Stephen Sondheim was like, Nathan, please come. I don't know that he talks like that, but please do it for me.
So in preparation for this today, Maddie and I were watching Stephen Sondheim interviews, and the one that we were watching was from when he was 80, when Finishing a Hat came out, mm-hmm. and he's got a little bit of that melt going on, but his voice is so resonant.
Is
like
it?
He's so clear and like very verbal for a man who seems to be made out of tapioca at a certain point. his handle of language is absolutely incredible, but mm-hmm. his voice is just crystal clear. I was like, damn.
Man.
I love that man. It's funny because this was like Maddie's first exposure to Sondheim. I was like explaining just.
He's lucky to have you.
Yeah, but as we were watching that interview, he was like, this guy just is obviously like a genius when it comes to this.
I honestly, we have a living genius among us. Like, there isn't another Rodgers and Hammerstein. Andrew Lloyd Webber is a hack compared to the music that this guy's writing. Like, nothing compared to him.
It's like the craft of, storytelling. And it's so funny hearing Sondheim talk about what his goals are when he's writing something, because it's like directly aligned with like what I want out of content. Like mm-hmm. he was talking about how with shows, like if you can remove the song and you're not missing any like of the character or the story, like it's a worthless song. And that's like so much of what I dislike about a lot of modern shows is that it's just time for the lead singer to sing, so now it's time to put a song in that somebody like shat out, but that's never the case with the Sondheim show. You always have like a deeper understanding of the story at the end of each song,
almost to the point where if I don't like something he's written or a part of a show or even the entire second act of Sunday in the Park, I almost go, I must not be understanding this because the man is
not ready for this.
Yeah, like I haven't lived this yet or something.
Yeah.
Or I wasn't there in the 80s when this was produced, so I don't get the reference or something.
I think that's the goal, truly, to have a show so airtight that like everything mean something. And like, to that point, I love that Samuel Bick, that assassin, does not have a song. He just has a really long monologue, mm-hmm. and he's in a car driving by himself, like, to the airport. Mm-hmm. And it's a really compelling part of the show because it breaks up the show. Totally. And also, I think much like other Sondheim shows are kind of not written for singers, various parts, because of either who he had in mind or... Yeah. The way the show structured, even like Desiree, the way
exactly. Oh my gosh, he was totally writing that for a woman who didn't have to sing, which is amazing, to write a lead woman that way.
I know, like the main character. But like with this too, it's so cool to think like we could do this with a group of people, and the person who fits this amazing Samuel Bick part is cannot be a singer. That can be whoever.
Totally.
Who's and Desiree? I saw Mary
from A Little Desiree. Night Music, the lead.
And she doesn't sing at all.
Well, she was written for. It was written for women who, I mean, it was written for, who's the mom in Mary Poppins? She
Glynis
has that.
John.
What is her name?
Glynis Johns.
Glynis Johns. Everybody yeah. say her name.
Glynis Johns.
But it was written for her, and then like Angela Lansbury's done it, and people, Catherine Zeta-Jones did it, even though I guess she's a musical theater
actor. Oh, it's that clown song?
Yes, and in the clown.
Or just the whole show is really written lower and like, mm-hmm. which is such an inviting thing to do, to include more people and like better actors, honestly, because not every actor is able to be like a coloratura, mm-hmm. you know, soprano.
I think that show in general, Henrik and Anne are probably the harder singing parts, and then a lot of the other ones are...
Well, he kind of writes, well, we're not going to go into that show, but he kind of writes it like the more classical pieces are like the fancy stuck-up people, and then he writes these very... conversational pieces for other, which is what his style does. Like, he does that, he writes to how people would be speaking, and
yeah,
that's something to say on this cadence. Podcast is like, he understands how we speak, so then he can write music that sounds like that and feels like that, which is really amazing.
Also on this chart of notable cast members, I guess in the 2020 revival, Sarah Jane Moore was played by Judy Kuhn. Did you know this?
Really? From Les Mis?
That Judy?
Yeah.
I know her from Pocahontas and Chess.
Was she Pocahontas?
She was Pocahontas. She was the singing voice of Pocahontas. And she was Florence in Chess. But it says that she was Cosette in Les Mis.
Yeah, that's how I know her.
It's crazy because you'd think she would be in Assassins earlier. I guess she also starred in Fun Home.
Yeah, how old is this woman?
Maybe she's 61.
Oh yeah, she was Sarah Jane Moore, they said. Okay.
Oh my God.
Wow, was she in the one I saw probably? That's crazy.
In 2020?
Oh no, what?
No, that's what I'm saying. She was in the most recent revival.
Well, I don't even know about that one. I think it was probably going to happen this year and didn't because of you know what.
This show is cursed, maybe.
Yeah.
I think so. Honestly.
What year did you see it, Devin? 90?
I saw it in 2005. Somewhere.
The Neil Patrick
Harris. Yeah, Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh, okay. So
Mario Cantone.
You saw Becky Ann Baker as Sarah Jane.
Who was the squeaky from in that? Because she was incredible.
Mary Catherine Garrison.
It sounds like Mary Catherine Gallagher.
It does. Well, there's also somebody on this chart whose name, Catherine Bradshaw. And I was like,
Carrie Bradshaw?
It's also funny because in the 2021, I don't know if you guys know who Tavi Jevonson is, but she's like the founder of Rookie Magazine, which is a very paranoia.
Mm-hmm. I've heard people have told me to look that up.
Yes, she's incredible. She's like
she was in it?
Yeah, she was squeaky. She was slated to be squeaky in 2020.
Was this a movie or what is this?
It says 2020 Off-Broadway Revival Classic Stage Company.
Oh my God. Oh, by the way, have you ever seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I still have not.
No, that's the latest.
It's the Tarantino movie that is like, honestly, if you know that it's about the Manson family murder, it's totally perfect. Tarantino like knocks it out of the park. I, however, started watching this movie with zero idea what was coming. And so it was just this buddy comedy with Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. And so I was just like, this is kind of cool, but they kept like, they were like, there's Roman Polanski, but then he like wouldn't be in it. And I was like, why aren't they having Roman Polanski be like in this? He's just like over there somewhere. They're not like really showing him. And then they're at like the Playboy Mansion and they're just like, I'm like, what is this movie about? And then at the end, it like totally comes apart and is about the Squeaky Frome is in it, played by Dakota Fanning.
Damn.
What?
I thought you guys would like to know that.
Yeah. Squeaky Frome is still alive?
What?
She's 71.
Oh my God, we're going to go find her on our road trip to get Priscilla Presley and Squeaky Frome autographs.
Frome was paroled from prison in 2009 after serving approximately 34 years. Since 2014, she's lived in Marcy, New York.
She got out of jail after trying to kill a president?
Scot-free.
That is insane.
Oh,
that is insane. You know,
I think I might can I just read a little bit to
you guys? I would love if you did that.
Okay, so in 1979, oh, this is the aftermath. So
the afterbirth.
On September 5th, 1975, Frome went to Sacramento's Capitol Park ostensibly to plead with President Gerald Ford about the plight of California redwoods, dressed in a red robe and armed with a Colt M1911 45 caliber. I can't talk about guns. I'm not
gonna. Yeah, who cares?
The gun was loaded with four rounds, but there was no round in the chamber. When Frome pointed the gun, she was immediately restrained. It didn't go off. She told Sacramento Bee, the paper, that she had deliberately ejected the round from her weapons chamber before leaving home that morning, and investigators found the round on her bathroom floor. Oh. She refused to cooperate with her own defense during trial. She was eventually convicted on the attempted assassination of the president and received a life sentence under 1965 law that made attempted presidential assassinations a federal crime. You know, I think that's pretty fair that it's a federal crime.
I think that it maybe should have already been.
Yeah,
other presidents had been actually killed by this.
We've had that. Yeah, we talked about this already, guys. Why didn't we make this a crime back then?
And then the aftermath, she was transferred around. I'm skipping a little bit.
So they basically treated it like a regular murder then. So that's why she got out. Wow.
Yeah, and she continued to profess total allegiance to Charles Manson. Vincent somebody wrote in Helter Skelter that she and somebody else were the only members of the Manson family who had not renounced him. And then this is really where I wanted to get to. She was released on parole from Federal Medical Clinic Carswell in August 14th, 2009, and moved to Marcy, New York, where she and her boyfriend Robert Waldner, who pleaded guilty to a manslaughter charge, live in a house decorated with skulls.
Of course they
do. That is what this Wikipedia says.
Can we please write a play? Can we please write a play about those two living together in a skull house? That is a play I want to
work. Squeaky skull house.
I'm very into that idea.
Only two bullet points under pop culture in Squeaky Frome's Wikipedia pages. She was in Assassins and she was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes! We've covered it. This is actually a podcast about Squeaky Frome.
What if we did that big of a deep dive on each of them?
That's what Sondheim did. See, like, basically Sondheim did all this research and then made a musical out of it, and then we're taking the musical and unpacking it, like, undoing all the research. Oh, well. All right, should we try to play a game and wrap things up? All right. Mm-hmm. This has been a great episode. Thank you both for such a great conversation about this show. So what would be like a carnival game that we could play?
Try to guess the weight of each of the assessments.
Oh my God. Yes, we can probably find it.
Yeah, do you think it's anywhere?
Mackenzie, so how about each of us goes around the circle and we each look up one of them and then the other two will try to guess. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have John Wilkes Booth's weight.
Wait. Is this at the time, not when he's an infant, obviously. This was after he had eaten a bunch as an adult and gotten to like a
sounds like this is the description of Booth when they were trying to find the man he killed. And here's my little thing. This was a while ago. I watched The Drunk History about John Wilkes Booth, and it's pretty funny.
Is it? I want to watch that. I love Drunk Histories. I want to do drunk musicals. But, okay. So I'm going to guess that he, and then are we just going to both guess? And then, oh, wait, why don't we both type it in the chat?
Oh, yeah.
We'll type it in the chat and then say it, and then we'll send it at the same time. Okay.
Yeah, I'll count you guys down to send it. His weight in pounds. Are you ready, Kate?
Yes. Wait. So we're chatting it to you?
Chatting.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to count you down and you're going to put it in. Ready? 3, 2, 1.
Okay.
This is funny. So I don't think, let's not play Price is Right.
No Price is Right rules. I was going to say that too.
So Kate guessed 190 pounds, a whopping 190.
I thought he was like a slender man.
And Devin guessed 169 pounds, which is so close. It says he was 160 pounds.
Yes.
You're just 9 pounds off. And the full description says, I'm going to read the full description because it's very detailed.
I can't believe there's so much detail on his weight.
It was a $30,000 reward. Description of John Wilkes Booth! !! Who assassinated the president on the evening of April 14th, 1865. Height, 5'8". Weight, 160 pounds. Compact build. Hair, jet black. Inclined to curl. Medium length. Parted behind.
Damn,
black
so
eyes
sexy.
And heavy dark eyebrows, wears a large seal ring on little finger. When talking, inclines his head forward, looks down.
Whoa. That's isn't some that information if you're playing him in Assassins.
Yeah.
I could play, I'm his height. I would just need a wig, a curly black wig. How old was he when he killed himself?
I just curly black wig. Oh, that's what I was gonna do for not his age, but I wanted to, because I can't find weight of the first three I looked up.
Bro.
So I was gonna say, can you guys guess how old Zangara was when he was
okay
killed?
All right.
John Wilkes Booth was 26 when he died.
Dude,
that's crazy.
That makes sense, because that's the time period where you're like really frustrated with the government. Like I can understand
and you're just like
you're
like,
lost
you're
and
craziest.
Yeah, totally.
Look at this sexy
okay
picture.
So oh, I'm like weirdly into him. I'm like a Squeaky Frome type.
But he's an actor, you know, like.
I know. Mm-hmm. That whole song is like, I guess I am kind of like this guy, except I didn't, you know, go through with killing anybody.
Well, that's what a lot of the Drunk History was about. Cute. Was like his brother was also an actor and more successful. And I'm pretty
that's
sure
what they taunt him with in the song.
His brother was in the play that Lincoln was watching when he got shot.
Uh-oh. Our American cousin?
Yes.
His brother's like, dude, stop messing with my shit.
And then he jumped on the stage and was like, six zapatadas. That's insane. What a crazy person.
Oh my God. Sometimes
to say the least. Yeah. That is the ultimate like Zoom bomb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like a real life bomb. Okay, Kate, what's your...
How old was Zangara when he was killed?
Was he... Mm-hmm. Can I ask a follow-up question? Did he...
Yeah.
Was he killed... Oh, he was killed, like, right after he was... He was executed right after. Is this...
Yeah.
Okay.
By electric chair.
So I'm going to say... Okay. I have a controversial answer. All right, ready? Okay, one more second.
Yes, I'm ready.
I'm sorry. Okay, ready? Kate, want to count us down?
Mm-hmm. 3, 2, 1, go.
Whoa.
Wow. Inverted. Okay, so Mackenzie is closer. He was 32.
Ooh, nice.
Wow, that was really close. And I said 43 for the listeners who cannot.
34 and 43. We're.
I like that we're thinking.
Yeah. Is he the social worker?
He was the one who tried to kill Roosevelt.
Because he had like the gut pain.
He had the stomach pains.
Oh my God. Okay. Here's my nuanced question for you guys. What weight came up when I typed in squeaky from weight? What did Google, the first answer, big and bold, what did it say on the screen?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay.
Wait, it's a number?
It is a number.
Okay.
Like weight is usually measured in.
Yeah, but I couldn't find her weight is why I'm asking.
Well, this is a question about what came up on Google when I searched it. All right, ready?
Okay.
Three, two, one.
Kate, that was my first answer. Yeah. That's literally what I wrote. And then I was like, it's gotta be something stupid.
Oh my God. I want to show you, I'm going to share my screen with you guys really quickly. And then I will post this.
Is it 110 pounds? I can't believe it.
Oh my God.
Tiny.
Yeah, it's like between what we said. Oh my God.
So that's what it said. Up
even.
Just like, well, I don't know. It's a weird, it was like a weird Google search answer. I was like, okay. But I thought it was entertaining enough.
That's so interesting because I typed into Google squeaky from height and weight and it didn't come up with that or anything. It was just like weight missing on Wikipedia.
It said, how much does Lee Harvey Oswald weigh?
It's so funny.
I like this game.
I do too.
Okay, I've got his weight and this might be hard.
This was at the time when he did it or...
These are his enlistment papers into the military.
Oh, that's a... Okay, so how...
These are his vital statistics.
How much did he weigh when he joined the military? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Ready?
Yeah.
Wait. Okay, I'm ready.
Three, two, one, go. Whoa, Devin, you sent that to me privately.
I didn't mean to.
So Kate is closer, even though Kate said 140 pounds and Devin said 144 pounds.
Whoa.
He weighed 135 pounds and he was 5'8".
That's how tall I am. I'm an assassin's height.
But you're 135 pounds is skinny as fuck.
I'm 140 pounds.
Oh, shit.
So he looked a lot like me.
So maybe you should go for Lee Harvey Oswald.
I would love to play that role. More than anything. I would love to play all of them. Wouldn't it be cool if you did a one-man show of assassins? It is funny to think about Lee Harvey Oswald just like pretending to be all these assassins, essentially.
Did Lee Oswald kill, is that like confirmed or no?
We don't know. The grassy knoll says maybe not.
When I was in school, it was...
Grassy knolls could talk.
Our teacher was telling us very much it is not confirmed. I think my teacher was very into conspiracies, and we all had to write a paper about who we thought actually did it.
Did you say the government?
I said...
The same person who killed MLK?
The same person who hid all the videos of the UFOs.
I wish I could find that paper. I think I said the mafia, but I don't know. Because I was really suspicious about why the government cleaned the car out so fast. Do you know about that thing?
It's all very disturbing.
It's like took the car and cleaned it before any forensics people could get into it. It's messed up.
All right. We can't go into this topic.
No. But while we're talking about controversy, isn't it crazy how we haven't had an assassin? Like, of all of the horrible things that we've experienced as a nation in the last, like, 20 years, mm-hmm. there really hasn't been any notable assassination attempts.
Well, my two theories are
lifetimes, right?
My two theories are they either made it so shameful to do it that everyone got shamed out of even trying, which is probably weaker compared to they probably got really good at spying on people and knowing when people are gonna try to kill the president, and like the security just got really intense.
The security is so different. That's true.
But I'm surprised that no one's like a sniper up in the trees and like can get him from anywhere. I mean, Carol Baskin was biking down that trail, and we know exactly how to take her down without being...
Well, that's such a good point about snipers, because we've had those DC snipers in our lifetime. Like, people in DC...
Yeah.
Violent.
Oh my God, yeah. Remember when they sent all those bombs to all the Democrats a couple years ago?
I saw something in the news, I forget, like it was some other country, maybe like Venezuela or something, and where they have like a communist situation, that like U.S. people, like a militia of Americans was captured, ready to like go and assassinate like the communist leader in like whatever country it was, which is crazy, because ultimately, and that there is like confirmed links between that militia and Trump.
Damn.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, it's not surprising, but that's like, come on, America. Like,
well, and with how many people hated Obama too, it's like, to your point, mm-hmm. isn't it crazy that like, we didn't even hear about an attempt on him? And maybe that trumpet playing next door neighbor is my cue to end this episode. This has been, do we want to do one more question, or we feel we've answered enough?
Well, let me see.
What's
who else
one last good? We haven't heard anything about
Gateau or Emma Goldman. You try to guess how much Emma Goldman weighs.
Guess how many musicals Emma Goldman is in.
We could do the presidents.
Yeah. Garfield.
Yeah.
Ooh. Okay.
Okay.
I've never
heard else to it, so I can
okay, I'll look it up. I'll look it up.
This is one of our best games.
Yeah, truly.
Yeah. Welcome to the carnival.
Listening to that Jesus Christ Superstar one where we had our names written on our heads.
Oh my God. Was it not good?
It was just hard to wrap your head around without it being
when
the audience also doesn't know, it's like, I
don't. Yeah, some of these games are hard to do over audio.
That's what makes it fun.
I want to do a Hollywood Squares type musical theater game show one day where we all have
record the video
and come up with like 10 games. Yeah. It would be a really cool way to like launch this podcast a little more once we have like, you know, we do have a bunch of episodes of it actually done.
Yeah.
We're covering all the territory. Okay, so I have an answer. So
how much does Garfield weigh?
How much does President Garfield weigh?
Okay, let me get this chat box. Hold on.
How much did he weigh before, and this is before he was shot? I have this weird fact that's like, sorry. I think I have this.
The stress of being shot.
Oh. Yeah, this is kind of like he dropped a lot of weight. So do you want to guess what? He dropped a lot of weight after he was shot. So he was bedridden with fevers and extreme pains. So
I'll guess post-shooting since
okay,
this is
post-shooting.
The
assessment. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
3, 2, 1, go. Whoa. Okay. They both said, Mackenzie said 142 and Kate said 140. And the answer is that it dropped to 130. So we have a winner in Kate Atherton.
How much did he weigh before?
I'm 210. 210.
Oh!
10!
He lost that much? Fuck. I want to get shot. Fuck.
LOL.
No, I don't actually. That's like my biggest fear.
I know.
When Anna texted everybody what their biggest fear was, I said getting shot.
No, you did not.
I did. And then we started playing Fear Factor and she was like, and now we're going to play. And I was like, oh my God.
I know. I thought, because I, to catch up the audience, we played a digital Fear Factor game. And when she said, what's your greatest fear? I said falling. And I was like, what am I going to have to do? Like jump off of something.
I know.
Push myself out of my apartment. If you don't, you lose the $10 Venmo prize. All right. That was a lot of facts, you guys. I think we should put this to bed. Thank you to our presidents. Thank you to our assassins. Thank you to the 90-year-old genius that is Stephen Sondheim. And thank you to you, our dear listener. Next time, we'll catch ya.
We'll do something different.
I guess with different musicals characters.
All right. Bye.